All right. Hello and welcome to our February Exceptional Speaker Bonus Call, powered by Exceptional Connections. I'm Cindy O'Neill Dady, the founder of Exceptional Connections Networking, as well as the educational series for Networking Mastery. These calls highlight our monthly Exceptional Connection Luncheon speakers who graciously agree to share their brilliance with our Exceptional Connections community and beyond. So we have folks on the line from back east as well, and we're real grateful that you've joined us. So we are very thankful to welcome Melina Palmer, founder of Defying Gravity, Brands That Soar. She was the featured speaker at our sold-out Tuesday, February 13th, Exceptional Connections Luncheon. And all in attendance were inspired by her talk, Consumers Are Weird, and they are. And she talks about how irrational behavior impacts your business. And so we're super honored to have her share with us today. So to set the expectation with everyone, Melina has generously agreed to share with us her talk, in fact, that she did on last Tuesday about consumers are weird. And she's going to share for about 20 to 35 minutes. And we'll then open up for Q&A with a plan to end by 1 p.m. So I just want to encourage you to stay on the line until the end, as we'll be sharing with our listeners some upcoming opportunities that are being offered by to our Exceptional Connections community. So it's my pleasure and honor again to introduce Melina Palmer as a presenter of our Exceptional Speaker Bonus Call today. Melina has been building and reimagining brands for a decade, most recently at Verity Credit Union, where the Fresh New Truth brand launch nearly tripled brand awareness in the last 2 years, or in less than 2 years. So Melina has always been fascinated by the psychological influences behind consumer behavior, and I have too. I think it's fascinating. So this inspired her to pursue a master's in behavioral economics from the Chicago School of Professional Psychology. Melina loves to bring innovative practices to organizations. Prior to joining Verity, Melina worked at an advertising agency, and she launched her own credit union consultancy with clients from across the country. She was also the first individual to graduate from the University of Washington's Global Honor Program with a degree in business. Well done, Melina. And her senior thesis was presented at the Association of Consumer Research Symposium in India. Melina also loves to sing, and she has a beautiful voice, and she sung the anthem at the Mariners game, and she says this is one of the coolest things she's done so far. That is great, quite an honor. And so it is my pleasure to turn this call over to the amazing and inspirational Melina Palmer. Take it away, Melina.
Thanks, Cindy. Can everybody hear me? Can you hear me, Cindy, I guess, since you can speak?
I can hear you, yes.
Perfect. Great. Well, thank you for having me last week and for bringing me back today. I really love speaking on this topic. It's fascinating to me, which is, of course, why I've continued to learn and love to expand the knowledge that people have about behavioral economics. I know that the concept itself, the title, doesn't make it sound very interesting. Often people hear the word economics and sort of tune out or get a little bit less intrigued. I know as a marketer, when I found the field as it has come about in the past several years, I thought it couldn't possibly be useful for me. It didn't seem like the right area, but it's essentially a field that has grown in popularity over the past decade or so, like I said, and it has come about by, I like to say, it's like if traditional economics and psychology had a baby, you would end up with behavioral economics. And so essentially what has happened is that traditional economics found that it had a problem, or others in the field of psychology found that there was an issue with traditional economics, and that it assumes rational people making logical decisions. And unfortunately, they aren't and don't, or we all aren't and don't, which makes it so that the models that are set up by traditional economics are not usually correct in predicting behavior accurately. And as many of us have come to find over the years, that people can't usually explain what they're going to do, you know, the behavior they're going to do. Somebody might say, you know, I choose this toothpaste. In a focus group, they would say they choose a particular toothpaste because it has baking soda in it, and then the other brand will put in baking soda, and the behavior doesn't change, so people don't go and buy based on what they think is driving their decisions, because really people just haven't been able to understand it up till the very recent past. And so what has happened over a series of many studies and countless hours of time and energy of psychologists and economists working together is finding these trends of how the brain actually works and how that impacts behavior. And so far, the field of behavioral economics is quite academic, which means it's very backward facing. And so being able to look at what happened in the brain, and being able to create sort of a theme or a bucket around those concepts, but then not actually applying, and this is what it means to you. And so what I do in my business is being able to help people to say, this is the concept, and this is how you could apply it, this is how it could impact you as in a company. So what I'm going to do today is talk a little bit first about how the brain actually works, so that we all are coming from the same place, have the same foundation. And then once I've told you a little bit about how the brain works, I'm going to get into a couple of the concepts of behavioral economics. As I'm sure you can appreciate, in a 20-30 minute call, couldn't possibly get into all of them, but a couple of the highlight concepts and explain how those work and how you can use those in your business. So the first thing that I like to think about with the brain is sort of how you as a person relate to your own brain. When you think about your brain and the way that it works, pretty much anything that you can conceptualize, anything you can think about in your own brain is your cognitive processing. So this is what you're conscious of in your brain. This is when you're aware that you're thinking, or you're thinking about thinking. It's a weird way to say it, but any time that you can think about what you're doing, that is your conscious space of your brain. And it's easy for most of us to think that this is the bulk of what our brains are doing, because that's all you can really relate to and know about. But in reality, there's the subconscious part of your brain that is operating as well. And we know it exists, but often tend to sort of write it off and undervalue how much it's actually doing. And so if you think about your subconscious brain, and this is different than left brain and right brain, it's really working concurrently as your conscious brain is working as well. Studies have shown that actually the highest number I've seen is 99.999% of your brain's processing is subconscious. The lowest study I've seen, for any naysayers that are listening and think that must be too high, you know, the lowest I've seen or heard is in 95%. So if we were to split the difference there and say that, you know, 99% is subconscious and 1% is the area that you're actually aware of, that's still a whole lot of stuff that your brain is chugging along on and working that you aren't really aware of. And so a way to think about this is, and things can move between your conscious and subconscious space pretty easily. And like I said, your subconscious is kind of like a filter where things are coming in and at you at every possible angle. You have scents and words and sounds and colors and all these concepts that are coming at you. And your subconscious area of your brain, which is throughout it, but is evaluating and saying, normal, 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 that's normal, that's normal, that's normal, and will then flag if something is off or outside of the rule of thumb that's created, something just isn't in the process that it's usually seen, it will flag your conscious brain to evaluate and, you know, start working on that item. And that's where you think, hey, my brain is working now and I'm doing things. And that's really in that 1%. Often people like to akin the brain to like a computer, and it's not exactly a computer, but the studies have shown that if you think about it in bits of processing, you know, your subconscious brain can be processing tens of millions of bits of information per second. Your conscious brain can only take 40. So that's, you know, 10 million to 40. There's a huge discrepancy there in what your brain is actually being able to do and how easily your conscious brain can get overwhelmed, and that impacts your decision-making process. An example I like to give in the subconscious space is if you think about learning to drive a car, especially if you were learning to drive a stick when you were 16 or whatever it happened to be, that you had to really think about what you were doing. Are your hands at 10 and 2, or are they at 3 and 9, and where the gas pedal is, and manually thinking about how to turn on your turn signal or making sure your headlights are on. You know, there's a lot of things that you're thinking about all the time. And over time, as you've gotten used to that, it's moved into your subconscious area of processing. Your brain is still evaluating all those things it's doing, but it's turned it into sort of a system. It knows what to do when, and it's very normal. And you're driving down the street, and then someone swerves into your lane, and you're very aware of what's happening. Really, that's where your conscious brain has been flagged. Or if you're driving next to a really big truck, maybe you tense up a little bit and are very conscious of the area on your lane or over a bridge, something like that. That's where your conscious brain has now been alerted of something where your subconscious is saying, you know, this is important to pay more attention to. I know for me, anytime I drive a different car than my own, I kind of forget that I have the step emergency brake. If it has a pull emergency brake, I kind of find myself stepping to nothing instead of pulling the e-brake, and then I feel very silly, which I'm sure many of us have done when we've driven different cars. So again, subconscious brain is going all the time. It's all throughout your brain. And unfortunately, this is really the sort of basis of how our brains developed. And then later in time is where that conscious, that cognizant space came in. And what that has done for us is that that subconscious space doesn't have a capacity for language. It makes the majority of your decisions, but it doesn't have a concept of language. And that means that it's making decisions, but it's not really logically being able to understand and address words in the same way that your conscious brain can. And so things that are really text-heavy can get overshadowed by images and things like that as you're building out programs and things. So the concepts I'm going to talk about today are loss aversion, anchoring and adjustment, and relativity, which are just a few of the concepts of behavioral economics. I'm going to tell you what they mean and how they impact your business on a regular basis and you as a consumer. So first is the concept, like I said, of loss aversion, which it's probably not surprising to anyone to hear or find out that people don't like to lose things. You know, it's not something that they are akin to. It can be difficult for people to find out that they're losing things, and they want to hold on to them. You know, when it comes to this, I often think of my four-year-old. He may not have been playing with something, but you can be darn sure if his sister picks it up, he will wail about how he was just about to play with it, and magically it's become his favorite toy of all time, and he can't possibly live without it until she picks up something else. And now that's his new favorite toy, and he can't possibly live without it. You can think of the seagulls from Finding Nemo, where they just say, mine, mine, you know, really focused on something that they want to keep or have. And while our adult brains are more advanced than children and seagulls, there's a primary foundation that remains, and that subconscious brain is not much more advanced than a small child in many ways because of that inability to have the speech around. My daughter has started now, she's learned the word mine, she's about two, and before It was very interesting to watch where she didn't have the words to say, but she would sort of grunt and point at something. She very much didn't want to lose things, even from a very young age. And for anyone that has children or has seen them play, you know, you're understanding this concept. So the problem is that our society has built around this in a lot of ways, but has done it sort of backwards and focusing on a gain instead of a loss. And so what the problem is with the statement of something like people like to have things, we should give them more things, is sort of the way that this is built in our society, where if you think that you know, you buy 10 and you get one free, if you swipe your card a certain number of times at the bank, then they give you some sort of a reward. If you fly with a particular airline, eventually you earn enough miles to fly to the other side of your state, or whatever it happens to be. You are now earning, you know, that carrot of earning something is not the same in the eyes of the consumer as it is to potentially lose something. And they might tell you they want gains, but it's not the case. And study after study after study in all sorts of areas have shown that actually the joy felt from a gain is about half of the pain that is felt from a loss, which means you need double of a gain to outweigh the pain you feel from a loss. And so if you feel, or if you think about the last time you went out to an event, maybe you put on a jacket you hadn't worn in a while, and you reached in the pocket and you found $20, and you were potentially really excited about that. Like, hey, great, I found $20, yay me, it's going to be a good day. And maybe then you got into traffic, somebody swerved into your lane, you forgot about that $20. Maybe you told one person, but you know, it wasn't really a huge impact on your ongoing life. You might not remember in a year or 3 weeks from now if you put on that same jacket. You won't remember that that was the one you were wearing when you found that $20 last time. In the alternate example, if you think about, so maybe now you're going to an event that you haven't been to in a really, that it's a very different type of an event that you can only use cash at, that's different than what we're used to these days. So you do a little bit of mental math and think, you know, $100 is going to be plenty. You'll probably have some to deposit back at the end, but better safe than sorry. So you go to the ATM, you get your cash, and then you drive to the event, you go to pay for parking, and find you only have four $20 bills. And you're frantically searching, trying to find that missing 20 where you know you got $100 out, and I can't imagine what happened, where did it go? And you're going to be feeling probably very grumpy and upset, definitely for the rest of the day. You're probably going to tell a lot of people about that $20 you lost. Potentially you're going to remember next time you go to use that ATM that this is the ATM that stole $20 from me, or if you were to go to that event again in the future, would remember this is where you lost that $20, you know, and potentially, you know, 10 years from now, you're still going to remember how aggravating it was when you lost that $20, which is the same value as the $20 found in a pocket, but losing it just feels different to you conceptually, and that can be very driving when it comes to behavior to not lose things. A good example of this is the overnight test drive. If you've bought a car in the last 10 years, potentially before that, but you know, really this has become more popular in the recent past, that the car dealership will let you take that car home and test it out when you're going to use it. And so they say, hey, you know, take it with you, you know, let us know in the morning, no big deal. And you potentially think, wow, that is so nice. That's so great of them that they're trusting me with this $20, $30, $40, $50, whatever it is, $1,000 vehicle. I could crash it and they would never, you know, I'm not on the hook for it. I don't own the car yet. But what you don't realize is that once your brain has kind of triggered a perceived ownership of that vehicle, which is very much enhanced by the power of touch. So driving a car for a test drive in general will increase the sales. But taking it home, where you can see it in the garage and you can see that the car seats fit and you take your kids out to dinner or you go for a date or whatever with your significant other, you know, being able to really see yourself having that car builds up this perceived ownership and you don't want to lose it. And so then you might realize that your other car, which seemed great, you know, is fine the day before and you weren't ready to buy yet. But now that you have this new one in the garage, it looks so much better than that piece of junk you were driving yesterday, because your brain has put this value on not wanting to lose the vehicle that it's now tied itself to. So the lesson would be to stop focusing on gains. Really want to be looking at the loss. And a question that I get a lot, and a concern that a lot of people have, is not wanting to be in a negative sales space, not wanting to have negative messaging or fear-based messaging, which I can completely sympathize with. I totally get it. There are ways to build loss aversion in without having to go into a negative feeling. An example that I'll give here is, if you think about from a banking perspective, just as Cindy said, I worked in a financial institution for quite some time. It's really common to have the advertisement or message from them that says something like, if you swipe your card 20 times this month, we will give you $50. Which sounds great. You know, you think, hey, $50 is a lot of money. That's not nothing. I would like to have that. It's not a huge change in my behavior. And you think you're going to do it. And then 3 months go by and you think, hey, did I do that? Like, I don't know. I must have forgotten. You know, next time it comes around, I'm absolutely going to focus on it. And that's part of that, you know, subconscious took over with all these other things that fell out of your conscious space, and you didn't do it. So the flip would be, instead of saying, if you swipe 20 times this month, we'll give you $50, switch and say, we put $50 in your account. If you use your card 20 times this month, you get to keep it. And the individual who gets this promotion can see that in their online or mobile banking in that current balance, not yet in the available. You know, they really want to move it over. They can start to see themselves having that $50, what they would do with it once it comes over. You know, maybe you're going to buy a gift card for somebody. Maybe you want to do whatever it is. You know, your brain starts to associate that as a real thing that you have, and it doesn't want to lose it. And you're more likely to be using your card to try to get that $50 that's visible and not lose it than you are for some hypothetical $50 you might get someday. The example I've given for coaches or, you know, people that are trying to help lead change amongst people, which is very common for a lot of entrepreneurs. An example I've given is if you were to say, I know that people have a hard time actually changing. It's easy to say what you want to do and you set goals for yourself. But if you were to, say, meet with clients on a regular basis, and say it's once a week, and they put forth some sort of goal that they have for themselves, saying they are going to do from week to week, and then you meet and they have a tendency to say, oh, I was going to get to it, but you know, this came up or that came up, and you know, I'll have to get to that next week, which happens a lot. You could do this for yourself as well. But as a coach, you could say, hey, Cindy, I have a jar it's a Cindy jar that sits on my desk. It has your name on it. And every week that you do what you say you are going to do, I'm going to put $20 in the jar. And it's just going to be accumulating, sitting there building up. But if at any point you don't, if you miss something you said you were going to do, I'm going to empty it out completely and you have to start from zero. And at the end of the year, you get whatever is left in the jar. You know, you're a lot more likely to, at the very least, set more realistic goals for yourself, of which stepping forward, even one small step at a time is better than not doing anything for your clients. You know, they're more likely to do something in that case. But being able to see that money building up and know that you could have had, you know, an extra $120 if you didn't skip whatever this thing happens to be, being more realistic, you know, it's a lot more likely that that person's actually going to move forward with the change that they set forward. So moving on, the next concept I'm going to talk to you about is called anchoring and adjustment. And so what this is essentially that a number, when it's stated or in someone's brain, can impact the way that they value something or how they think about something in a really interesting way. So a number that gets thrown out or is in your brain, even if it's really arbitrary, is going to impact the way that you think about things. You set it as an anchor and then you move one way or the other. If you were to think about the last two digits of your social security number, let's say, which again is totally arbitrary, someone who has the numbers of 8, 9 as the last two digits would value a random object higher than somebody whose last two digits were low, like 1, 2. And you know, the studies have shown that even though that's totally unrelated to if I was to hold up a coffee mug, you know, and say, hey, how much do you think this thing costs? You know, somebody with those, if I had asked you to think about those two digits of your social first, it's going to impact the way that you're valuing the cost of that item, which, again, makes absolutely no sense. It's not related, but it's sort of set in your brain as something to move forward with as an anchor. And this can be impactful in a lot of ways when it comes to pricing, and it can be important in a lot of those concepts. The other thing is that sort of the, you know, first item to market can really set the price for everyone else. And if you think about Starbucks, it's a very interesting space that they were able to come in and make it so people would value their coffee as much more expensive than others. A lot of us buy a lot of Starbucks, obviously. There's really one on every corner, or two or three here in Seattle. But if I was to go to, if you went to a regular, quote-unquote, coffee shop, you know, local, and it was the same price, or even before Starbucks came around, that price was so high compared to other coffee. You know, they really had to establish themselves in a completely new category to be able to set their anchoring price so much higher, because the cost of a cup of coffee is, you know, 50 cents or whatever it happens to be anywhere else. To justify paying $4, they have to sort of set themselves in a new category to create a new anchor for that pricing, so that it's not locked in with where other prices tend to be. Similarly, if you're launching a product, if you think about the iPad when it first came out, or iPods when they were coming out, and we all might have thought, oh man, that price is ridiculously high when they came out at $1,000 or whatever it happened to be for the specific item. It seemed really high, but if they would have set their anchor lower and then were to adjust up, it's very difficult for people to move up from an anchor like that when it comes to pricing, whereas that high anchor of saying it's $1,000 and then eventually it comes down, now when it's come down to $5.99, that sounds like a really great price because you have that anchor of $1,000 in your brain of what it was once, versus if it had always been $5.99 or $650, whatever it happens to be, you know, it doesn't have that same gravitas of the value of what it could have or would have been at one time. Stepping out of the pricing arena on this, a really interesting study was done at a grocery store with end cap displays. And so half the time they had the end cap say Snickers bars. So it was an advertisement for Snickers. So the Snickers bars, buy them for your freezer. And then the other half of the time, it looked exactly the same. The only difference was, so it said Snickers bars, buy 18 for your freezer. And so 18 instead of them, of which I think pretty much everybody would agree 18 is a lot of Snickers bars and probably more than any of us have bought on one occasion if you weren't buying, you know, fun-sized ones for Halloween or buying them for, you know, kids' soccer team or whatever it happens to be. You know, 18 is not a normal number of Snickers bars, to buy for most people. And so it seems a little bit arbitrary, and it doesn't seem like it should make a big difference. But in reality, when that number 18 was used instead of just saying buy them for your freezer, there was a 38% increase in the number of Snickers bars that were purchased. And what when you think about that, it seems a little bit crazy. Why would that even have an impact? It doesn't seem like it should. But in the case of the them scenario, so buy them for your freezer, you know, you think, oh, you know, maybe them is plural, like I'll get two, maybe three Snickers, and you buy them and go on your way. And maybe you're going to put them in the freezer and eat them tomorrow or next week or whatever it happens to be. You're going to stock up. In the other scenario, you hear the number, you know, buy 18 for your freezer, and you think, oh, geez, 18, I don't need that many. I'm so much better than anybody that would get that many. I'm just going to get 6. And if you realize, you know, 6 sounds so much less than 18, but it's still more than you would have bought on your own without that tiny little nudge, that little push toward a bigger number that was set as an anchor, and you adjusted your way down from it. So really the lesson there is to not be afraid to throw out big numbers. It can be a little bit scary sometimes, especially when they're arbitrary like this, but really when I said that to you, you didn't think, and if you had seen that advertisement in the store, you wouldn't have thought, oh, that's outrageous. Like, who's buying 18 Snickers? I'm going to write a letter. I'm angry that they would offer that. You might think it's a little bit silly. I think it doesn't impact you, but in reality, it actually does. This is also, if you, in a grocery store, similar example where it's the, instead of saying a dollar each, where they'll say yogurt is 10 for $10, people will buy more than they would otherwise if it's the 10 for $10 versus $1 each, even though in most cases it's exactly the same. The next concept I'm going to talk about is called relativity. And what this really has to do with is that we don't value things. Your brain really likes to compare things, and it needs different points of comparison to enable it to set up a value on something. And it can't, it'll always find some comparison point, and if there's not enough similar between two items, then it's going to value on price. And sometimes that's what you want, but a lot of times it's not. And if you think about, if you've ever gone to or seen an advertisement at an electronics store for a television that's maybe very fancy and it's $1,000, and then there's a pretty similar model inside that's only $700, then you end up getting that one. Perhaps when you go in, you know, you were brought in by this bigger thing, which is sort of the anchor at that $1,000 value, which made you think the $700 looks better. But your brain was able to compare if the features were very similar, if they were both 4K and they were both curved TVs and whatever it happens to be. You know, your brain can compare those two things on their what they have in common versus if they were two separate items completely. So if you, the example of the differing items would be, if you're running a store that sold small appliances and you brought in an espresso machine and you don't have any espresso machines out before, you've never had them in the store, it's the first thing. So you put your espresso machine, it's for $150, you know, you put it next to a microwave and a toaster. And it's sitting there on the shelf. You know it's a really good value. You didn't put that high of a markup on it because it's new and you want people to be excited about it. And then 6 months go by and nobody has bought an espresso machine. And in this case, and if you think about, you know, in your own company, you know, it's very common where you'd say, man, this thing's not selling. People must not be buying espresso machines like I thought they were going to. This isn't the next big thing. I'm just going to pull it from the shelf. Or really mark it down to get rid of them. And that's what a lot of us would do in that situation. But in reality, the problem is, you know, an espresso machine is not like a microwave. An espresso machine is not like a toaster. And so it has nothing to show its value to your subconscious brain. What you should actually do is get different model of an espresso machine that is twice the size and twice the price, and ideally would be the same color, and put it right next to it. So now you have a $300 very large espresso machine for a home next to what looks now like a compact, less expensive introductory model of an espresso machine. And somebody will now say, wow, what a great deal. I haven't had an espresso machine before, you know, but this seems like a really good introductory model. You know, it's half the price of this other one. I might upgrade to that at some point. But now I'm going to go ahead and step in and get this intro model. That's a really great value, and I'm going to go ahead and get that. It's crazy that this ends up working with, and there have been lots of studies on this works in real estate, this works in travel, this works in dating, that if you were going out trying to get yourself a less attractive but wing woman that looks a lot like you, but just a little bit less attractive, is the thing that is going to be helping you to be seen as more attractive to those around you. I would suggest to not tell that person that's why you picked them to go out with you out on the dating scene or whatever it happens to be. But in the case of travel, you know, if you have if somebody was to tell you you can get this package to Paris, this package to Rome, or this other Rome package, your brain is going to sort of discount that Paris thing, because even if it's a great trip and a better value than either of the two Rome trips, it doesn't have a comparison point. Whereas the Rome trip, if you have this really extravagant, opulent, too expensive one, and then there's one that is less expensive and a good value and something you would want to do, you know, you can really, your brain can look at those two things and say, well, this is the better value of the two Rome trips, so I'm going to do that, and it makes a decision based on that item. Or in shopping for homes, two colonials versus one modern type of house, you know, your brain is going to be evaluating between those things. And if you're looking at products that you offer in your business, being able to show the, if you have an item that you're wanting to sell or promote, if you do services, let's say, and you have a package that you know is the one that you really want to have out there and that would be the best value for your clients, what you would want to do is set up a version that is just sort of the extravagant but a much lesser value of that, that can sit right next to it and have that one listed first. Remember, for your anchor, if you're looking at these on a website or something, you want to anchor with the highest price, and then have the better value, lower price come in after that. And then you can have a third option that's something that's unrelated, which again can help push toward that item that you really think is the best value for your clients or customers. An example from The Economist that was done many years ago, they had an advertisement that was promoting their digital only and their print subscriptions. And so they had a version where, you know, the digital only subscription was about $60. There was a print only subscription that was $125. And then they had a combined print and web subscription that was the same $125 as the print only subscription. And in a test, 84 of the people who were shown these options chose that print and digital combination of for $125, and 16 picked the digital only, and nobody wanted the print only subscription. Where it's really clear to see that for the same $125, I can add digital. You know, the value of digital is $60 based on that first option. You know, might as well get that. That's a better value. And then it was run again where they pulled the print only subscription. So now you have a direct comparison where often you'd say this again, if you would have pulled that espresso machine off the shelf, in this case, you know, to say that it's now, that's now gone. If everybody picked, you know, print or digit or the print digital combined or the digital only, you know, I can remove print only because nobody's picking it. It doesn't need to be there. When they did that, it actually brought down the choices that from 84 people that had picked the combined print plus web or digital subscription in the first run around, went down to 32. So it went from 84 down to 32 that chose that option, and the digital only went up to 68. And what happened there, and that was 16 before, if you remember. So what happened in this case is now that, so print plus digital and digital only aren't really similar enough that your brain can compare and value them. So the only thing that's left to compare them on is price. And in this case, 60 is better than 125. I'm going to go with digital, and then maybe someday I'll add on and upgrade to the print only. You know, you can logically convince yourself about saving trees or whatever it happens to be that you justify that less expensive option. And that's a huge change, a big shift. That was just by removing one option that no one picked the first time around. So that decoy, theoretically, if you want to call it that, really helped to drive people into making the better value choice, but you can't see that value when the print only is now gone. So keeping that in mind when you're pricing. I'm going to go ahead and open up for questions here, but just before we do, you know, I talked about loss aversion, which is, you know, to stop focusing on gains in the things that you set up, that anchoring and adjustment, not being afraid of big numbers, and then with relativity of using a decoy item that's a less attractive version of whatever it is that you're really trying to promote or let your customers know about. Those are the three concepts I talked about, as well as how the brain works and really what behavioral economics is in general.
Wow. Thank you, Melina. Thank you so much for offering so much value and amazing insights and for generously talking about how consumers really are weird, aren't we?
Absolutely.
We have interesting ways of being able to process things, but I love that, you know, from a business standpoint, we can be able to kind of frame things in such a way that we, and you and I were talking about this before the call, we're not trying to, you know, we're not trying to manipulate anything, but we just be conscious of, you know, how our brains work and how we can, you know, frame things in a way that makes sense to people instead of working against ourselves, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
So, yeah. So, you know, this is a great opportunity to ask any questions you have. Melina set a really wonderful foundation for understanding how our brains work and, you know, the different concepts of loss aversion and anchoring and adjustment and relativity. So I've gone ahead and opened up the call. If you have any ambient noise going on behind you, please, you know, feel free to mute yourself. But I've opened up the call, so if anybody has questions, this is a great time to be able to get them answered by somebody that's so passionate about the subject.
Well, Melina, this is Gail. I can certainly relate to the new car thing about bringing it home and, you know, seeing it in your garage, and because that really, we are a victim of that. It's worked on us several times. You know, I think that's it's an interesting concept, and I don't think I've ever thought of it in that way. But now that you bring it out, I can see how it's very effective in trying to sell something. So thank you for that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, studies have shown too, I think I mentioned this briefly, but, you know, your brain, even where you don't already own whatever that item is, you know, that there's a lot of power in your brain will create a perceived ownership over whatever that item happens to be very quickly, even where you don't actually physically have it. In some cases, though, if you do have something that you're selling that you can get people to touch and use, I think, Gail, I think you mentioned you did some, for network marketing, something like that. So something like if you think about the Tupperware parties of yore, and that those have turned into, whether it's, Scentsy or Arbonne or whatever those happen to be, where you're actually getting people to try things on or to use the makeup or try the foundation or whatever it is, you get to, your brain starts to see and have this valuation that it's putting on that item and associating it with sort of part of your identity. You also get into there's definitely a lot of sort of the bandwagon effect that comes up where people do say they like to be unique or they think they want to be unique. We think people want to be treated as individuals, which in a lot of cases is true, but there's actually a lot of power in the populace in this case. And if everyone's doing something, where your mom might have said, if everyone was going to jump off the bridge, would you do it too, type of a thing, that your brain really does think that way. If you get something in the mail saying, congratulations, you're in the top 10% of people when it comes to saving energy or whatever it happens to be, you would think in sending that, that means that those people are going to then keep up that behavior. But actually, their brain then says, oh, wow, I'm doing way more than I need to do. I'm way above the average. I can afford to slack off a little bit and be part of that consensus. So, understanding how people like to do things that everybody else is already doing.
Well, the whole thing is just fascinating. And it's, thank you for bringing a perspective to simple things that I never thought about before.
Of course.
I love the idea of what you said in terms of perceived ownership, because that's exactly right. You're putting people, having them have an opportunity to really experience that product or service. And even if it's like a test drive of a car or, for the business I'm in, send out cards, we do gift accounts. So that gives people a chance to actually send a card and experience that. So I hadn't really thought about it in terms of, the behavioral, kind of reasons that we do what we do in businesses. But I think it really is fascinating. So anybody else have any thoughts or questions?
Hey, this is Rosie Gremmert. And, Cindy, I'm with you on that. I have a behavior that's worked in my business, but I didn't know why. And now I know why, because what we'll do is we'll loan people a kit. We basically put an entire a diffuser and an essential oil reference book and, a starter kit all in a cute little package, and people get to borrow it for a week.
Right.
And so when they borrow it for a week, then they don't want to give that up. That's the mentality behind that, right? So,
right.
I love that you said about the 18 Snickers bars, because, for example, we have BOGOs running this week, and so we're putting things out that let them know what that value is. But what if it was more like buy 5 for your gift closet? I mean,
absolutely.
Then people go, oh yeah, I need to buy at least 2 or 3 of them so that I've got some in my gift closet, so that when my girlfriends have special days, I've got a present for them. Right.
Right. First, hi, Rosie. It's been a long time since I've seen or talked to you. I hope you're doing well. some other concepts that sort of play into that. So there's some a reciprocity piece. So giving someone something makes them feel they feel compelled to give something back, whether that's buying it or whatever it happens to be. So that's something that is at play there as well with that kit that you're giving out, which is a really great strategy. Also, if you think about infomercials, the things that they do and say are really, I think, just amazing examples of behavioral economics in general, where you get the 30-day trial, no, you know, obligation or whatever. And those people know people get into their set default and they're less likely to send it back. The other thing that if you were to try, you know, the stocking up, another thing that you can do is if you imply some sort of scarcity. So if you say buy one, get one with a limit of 10, it seems silly, but people will go, oh, geez, I better buy quite a few. This happens. This is another grocery store example where people will buy way more cans of soup than they would have otherwise. You're going to stock up when you have that limit. And so if you were to just put a limit on that BOGO, you know, you might see people get 4 or 6 or 8 when they have a 10 item limit, which they might not have done otherwise.
Yeah, they have a limit of 5, and that's actually doTERRA's marketing makes it so they have a limit of 5 per day.
Nice. Perfect. And so that is, I think, a good example of sort of what I do in my business, which is, you know, being able to come in and evaluate what it is that you're doing and find, like you said, Rosie, there's something that you've been doing that works, but you didn't really know why. You potentially have some other things that don't work and you don't know why, or some goals that you're trying to accomplish and not sure how to be able to do them or test them. You know, being able to work with businesses or entrepreneurs to come in and say, let's look at everything, see how things have worked for you, how they haven't, and build some tests around it to look at these concepts, because there are quite a few. I do have an ebook available that anybody on the call could get for free if you go to my website. But being able to understand the concepts where I can talk over with whomever about how they work and what's working and what's not, and come up with some actual solid action plans of things to test and try to make your advertising, your branding, whatever it is, more brain friendly, as I like to call it.
I love it. Thank you.
I love it. I love it. That's great. And I like the way, you know, like you said, Melina, using strategies, it actually helps, I think, allay concerns, you know, with this philosophy of being unreasonable. Like, oh, you know, it's not reasonable, like with the BOGO, Rosie, for somebody, you know, to buy 5 of them. Like, you know, you're going to be, you're being a hog, you know, you're not playing, you know, in the nice in the sandbox. But, you know, it's actually, it is a strategy to be able to say, you know what, it's totally reasonable to get 5 because, you know, you'll be prepared for birthdays or the holidays, or you can be generous. You know, I love the different ways that you can frame things.
Mm-hmm.
Fun.
Melina, what is your book and what is your website?
Thank you so much for asking. So my book is called The 10 Behavioral Economics Concepts You Need to Know and How to Apply Them. And as you know, I talked about 3 today. I have sort of a top 10 that are featured in my book, and it's very similar to what I talked about today about how those work and ways you can use them. And you can get that for free on my website, which is brandsthatsoar.com.
Great leading question. Thank you for that, Gail.
You will. Yes, thank you.
So I want to be able to just ask you, since, you know, again, would appreciate the opportunity for people to know how to learn more from you. What else, Lort, would be helpful for people to know about how they can engage with you or learn more or work with you, Melina?
Yeah, so I, like I said at the beginning, behavioral economics so far is very academic, and so I'm one of the early ones that's working on how you actually apply this in a business. And so one of the things I like to do is when I do get questions, I share them and different concepts. I do short videos via YouTube or on my Facebook, which is just, you know, Facebook.com/brandsthatsoar. And being able to share those concepts. And so if people do have questions of how something would work, or, you know, Rosie being able to point out, hey, I love that you mentioned this. Now I know why this other thing works. You know, thanks for letting me know. That's something that I could share and do a video about. Or if somebody had a question of, you know, hey, how can I use loss aversion in my real estate business or whatever it happens to be, To ask those questions. I appreciate those at any time, and you can just email me, melina@brandsthatsoar.com, if you do have any sort of thoughts or questions. I'm always happy to address or answer them. And then, like I said, the easiest way to work with me is that I do speaking engagements like the one I did last week, but also being able to come in, and whether that's over the phone or in person, and evaluating what you're doing in your marketing or brand space, and what's working, what's not, why it might be working or not, and then setting up those tests of different items or tweaks that can make a big difference. As you saw in that Snickers piece, one word change was a 38% increase in the sales of Snickers bars. And Snickers are something that people know about. It exists in pretty much everyone's mind here in the U.S. at least. And, you know, just a simple, tiny little tweak like that can make a huge difference.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much, Melina. I really appreciate all your the generosity of your sharing, your passion for behavioral economics, and really bringing it to light as a discipline that, you know, we can use those principles in our business and you know, really be able to, you know, have people understand the value of what we offer in a much easier way. So thank you so much for that.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So I just want to end the call by, you know, just letting the listeners know that we have our next educational series for Networking Mastery Skill Shop will be offered by our presenter, Karen McGregor, from Abbotsford, British Columbia, on March 27th, Tuesday, March 27th. We still have room at the early bird price point of $97, and the price will be going up to $160. I'm trying to implement your strategy here, Melina. The price is going up, so this is a good time to lock in the early bird rate. So basically, if you just go to ECN-educational-series-march.eventbrite.com or email me, and I'll make sure we get a seat for you at our event so you can join us. So thank you so much for being a part of our February educational series, our bonus call. And thank you again, Melina, for joining us and for your, you know, just incredible generosity in sharing not only with our Exceptional Connections community last week, but on this call today as well.
Of course. Thank you, Cindy.
Yes, absolutely. So make sure you take advantage of Melina's generous offer and go to brandsthatsoar.com. And she has an ebook again, that she mentioned, the 10 behavioral economic concepts you need to know and how to apply them. So awesome. Thank you, guys. Our next Exceptional Connections is on Tuesday, March 13th. And our speaker is Maria Luxinger. She's a certified professional life coach, and she's going to be offering a first quarter goal check-in. She's going to be talking about the wheel of life. So we're excited to be able to have her share with us. And wishing all of you, wherever you are in the country, I know we've got people from Utah and from Virginia on the line today, wishing you a wonderful week and a wonderful day. Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.